Welcome to Insight, the Radio Baha'i Public Affairs Show.
5 years too many. Human rights are indeed in crisis in Iran today. So tonight we're here to raise awareness of a plight of those who are unjustly persecuted in Iran and to call for the immediate release of all prisoners of conscience in Iran. In particular, we're here to call for the release of the Yaran-e-Iran, or the Friends of Iran. For those of you who may not know, the Baha'i faith originated in Iran in the mid-1800s and has since become a global religion. And about 300,000 Baha'is live throughout Iran, making them the country's largest religious minority. Baha'is in Iran have been repressed since the very founding of the religion, but the persecution of the Baha'is reached unprecedented levels after the Islamic Revolution in 1978.
Welcome to a special extended edition of Insight. I'm Bhakti Larry Huff. The voice you just heard was that of actor-comedian Rainn Wilson. A member of the Baha'i faith, Wilson was speaking at a program to help launch the 5 Years Too Many campaign in Washington, D.C. on May 6th. The 5 Years Too Many campaign was launched by the worldwide Baha'i community on May 5th, as Wilson indicated, to call for the immediate release of 7 Iranian Baha'i leaders and all innocent prisoners of conscience in Iran, and to commemorate the 5-year anniversary of the imprisonment of the Baha'i leaders, known as the Yaran-e-Iran, or the Friends of Iran, an ad hoc committee formed to see to the needs of Iran's Baha'i community. As of May 14th, the Iran had been imprisoned exactly 5 years. This edition of Insight focuses on the campaign and the 7 imprisoned leaders. During this program, you will hear interviews with Anthony Vance, director of the U.S. Baha'i Office of Public Affairs, and Araj Kamalabadi of Southern California, the brother of Faribah Kamalabadi, who is one of the Iran. You will also hear excerpts from the May 6th event that feature comments from author Roxana Saberi, who was incarcerated with Iran members Faribah Kamalabadi and Mavash Sabet in Iran, and you'll hear bio sketches of the imprisoned leaders. First, our interview with Anthony Vance, director of the U.S. Baha'i Office of Public Affairs. Hello, Anthony Vance, and welcome to Insight.
Oh, thank you. It's good to be with you.
First of all, just give us a little history, kind of bring us up to date on this issue. Why are Baha'is in general persecuted in Iran, and how is the government of Iran involved in this?
The persecution of the Baha'is in Iran actually began with the inception of the Baha'i faith in the mid-1800s. At that time, the vast majority of the clergy of Iran rejected the notion that a new religion could arise after Islam. And so they persecuted the members of the Baha'i faith and its predecessor faith, the Babi faith, killing approximately 20,000 people over the course of 20 years from roughly 1845 to 1865. And yet at the same time, there was a significant minority of clergymen who actually accepted the new faith. And rather than that being a cause for, you know, calm and sober reflection, it actually caused the clergy to be even more alarmed lest this new faith gain widespread adherence within Iran. Now, there's been periodic persecution of Baha'is since that time, occasionally quite brutal, but certainly discrimination on a continuing basis ever since the inception of the faith. Then in 1978 and 79, with the Islamic Revolution, a government that was made up of clergymen, that was led by clergymen, eventually came into power. And that government decided that it was time to eliminate, essentially, the Baha'i faith in Iran. So in the early 1980s, through the mid-1980s, there were almost 200 Baha'is executed by the government. And most of them had been in leadership positions, either as the leaders of national councils that are called National Spiritual Assembly. 9 members of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of Iran were abducted and never seen again. And then in December of 1981, 8 out of the 9 were arrested and then a few days later executed. Their replacements disbanded at the order of the Iranian government. All national elected formal administrative institutions of the Baha'i faith in Iran in August 1983. This was an extraordinary good faith act by the Baha'i community to dismantle its administrative formal administrative system at the order of the government. And ironically or tragically, the government wasn't satisfied with that and eventually executed 7 of the 9 members of the Third National Spiritual Assembly, the one that had disbanded itself. So today, the individuals about whom the campaign is about are members of a 7-member ad hoc committee that deals with basic things within the Baha'i community, marriages, divorces, funerals, and they were doing this for a number of years, actually, before, and serving as an informal link between even not only within the Baha'i community, but also as a means for the government to communicate with the Baha'i community. So it came as something of a surprise when in May 2008, the government arrested 6 of the 7 members. It had already arrested in March the 7th member of that group. And since that time, they have been in prison, and they have experienced various kinds of abuses. They have also been the subject of complete procedural miscarriage of justice without sufficient opportunity or almost no opportunity to consult with their attorney, and their attorneys had almost no opportunity to view the evidence that had been brought against them. They were accused of things such as spying for Israel and corruption on earth and these kinds of obviously made-up security-related charges. Of course, the real basis of the charges that they simply do not like the religion of these individuals.
All right. You're listening to Insight, the Radio Baha'i Public Affairs show. And I'm Bhakti Larry Huff, speaking with Anthony Vance of the Baha'i Office of Public Affairs in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the 5 Years Too Many campaign and the imprisonment of the Iran, which has led to this effort. Mr. Vance, are you able to get reliable information on the physical conditions of these leaders?
We know that they all are suffering from various physical ailments. I mean, I won't go into any details on the 7 individuals, but they all have all suffered from a variety of ailments. We're trying to maintain a certain amount of privacy, of course, about their about things related to their physical health. And, of course, the conditions of the prisons in which they've been placed. Currently, the 5 men are in Gohardasht prison, and the 2 women are in Evin prison. Gohardasht prison is well known for its difficult sanitary conditions as well as the number of dangerous criminals who are actually imprisoned there. Evin prison in Tehran is known for as being a place where many political prisoners are placed, and it also has a notorious reputation because of reports from a variety of sources that people have been tortured there. The 2 women are located in Evin prison.
Are they able to receive visitors or phone calls?
Yes, they do get weekly visits. So their relatives are able to visit to actually see them most weeks. And so that is a good thing that we are thankful for, so that at least some sense as to how well they're doing can be obtained.
I know that in the United States, at least, and even other parts of the world, but particularly in the United States, certain activities have occurred on behalf of the Iran, including House and Senate resolutions. And on March 12th, the 113th Congress of the United States introduced 2 resolutions in the Senate, Resolution 75, and in the House, Resolution 109. What impact do you believe these efforts have made on the overall effort to get the release of these imprisoned leaders?
Yes, we think that congressional resolutions are extremely important, and for several reasons. As some of your listeners know, in the as I mentioned earlier, there were many Baha'is who were executed in the 1980s. But then finally, with congressional resolutions, statements by the President of the United States, statements by other world leaders, and resolutions passed by other legislative bodies, such as the parliaments of several countries in the world, well, together with also resolutions from the United Nations, all of this cast a bright spotlight on the situation. So So despite all of the bluster of the Iranian government and dismissing all of this attention, it in fact did have an impact. And the most visible impact was the slowing of the execution of Baha'is. That had not occurred. In fact, there was a period of time when there were no executions for several years. And there have not been executions for the last several years also. So this does definitely have an impact, and it may end up resulting in the release of the prisoners, but we know that if the world did not speak out, then the situation would very likely be much worse.
All right. You're listening to Insight, the Radio Baha'i Public Affairs show, and I'm Bakhtil, speaking with Anthony Vance of the Baha'i Office of Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. Mr. Vance, what do you think is the significance of the 5 years too many campaign?
Well, the thing that is so noteworthy about this campaign is that it is truly global. There have been events not only in Washington, D.C., but also in several European countries and on other continents such as Australia and in South America and Brazil. And we're anticipating other reports that we'll see over the coming days. So it's very gratifying to see that foreign ministers have made statements, like the foreign minister of Canada and others have made statements that are strongly supportive of these seven individuals. And, of course, these seven individuals are symbolic of the 116 Baha'is in Iran who are currently in prison, together with another 448 people who are free but out on bail, awaiting trial or sentencing or the appeal of their sentence or the imposition of their sentence. So there is a very large number of people who are living in constant risk of being placed in jail. But the seven leaders, ad hoc leaders of the Baha'i community, are symbolic of this level of oppression that's being experienced by the Baha'i community as a whole. And they are also, in some sense, symbolic of all prisoners of conscience in Iran, because it is very likely, if one understands a little bit about the nature of government in Iran, that if it were to begin to treat the Baha'is better, it would probably also begin to treat others better. That is, journalists who've been put in prison merely for writing factually about what they have uncovered, lawyers who've been put in jail merely for doing a good job for representing their clients, you know, artists who've tried to express themselves, and many other people who are prisoners of conscience who have, for some reason, not expressed themselves in a way that the regime finds acceptable.
Well, given all that, is the Baha'i community in Iran able to function at all openly, given the threat, you know, of imprisonment and worse that they are under there?
No, this is the Baha'i community in Iran is not free to operate openly in the way that it would in most free countries in the world. And so Baha'is place themselves at great risk just merely by stating that they're Baha'is to other individuals, and certainly stating so publicly is an invitation for arrest. So it is a very difficult situation for them. And in fact, even if they don't state publicly that they're Baha'is, they are denied many of the ordinary benefits in society, such as being able to get a higher education, being able to obtain their pension from their government service, being able to obtain jobs unless they deny that they're Baha'is, which is something that we do not do. You know, there are all of these different things that are designed in a systematic fashion to impoverish the Baha'i community and to make it a community that is not educated at all. These are the two things that the government is hoping to do very slowly over the course of time. And we know that this is the case because this was the subject of a memorandum that was actually signed by the Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, back in 1990. 1991 that was issued by an official who was Mr. Golbaghani. That memorandum indicated that Baha'is should be excluded from the university system and that, in general, their progress should be blocked.
I see. You're listening to Insight, the Radio Baha'i Public Affairs show with Anthony Vance, Director of the Office of Public Affairs of the Baha'is of the United States. Mr. Vance, what is the American Baha'i community in particular doing toward the goal of the release of the Iran, and what can others do to help?
Well, one of the most important things that the average person can do, including any, not only just a member of the American Baha'i community, but the average individual, can call into his or her senators and congressmen. There is to support legislation, resolutions that are currently pending before the United States Congress. One of those resolutions is Senate Resolution 75, and the other is House Resolution 109. These are resolutions that condemn the government of Iran for its persecution of the Baha'is, and these resolutions call for the immediate release of these Baha'i prisoners, not just the seven members of the ad hoc leadership group, but also other prisoners of conscience in Iran that are imprisoned for their beliefs or their religion.
Now, as the nation considered the world's human rights leader, how do you view the U.S. government's role in this matter and other human rights violations around the world, even though the 5 Years Too Many campaign and other efforts have been international in scope, but do you see a specific and unique role for the United States in this effort?
Well, of course, the United States is the leader of the free world and is looked to oftentimes as an example to follow. So whenever a senior U.S. government official makes a statement or the United States Congress passes a resolution, it's something that's paid attention to by other governments around the world, and they will oftentimes emulate the behavior of the United States and take positions that are similar. So even though we're a single country, we're a country that still has quite a bit of influence internationally. And governments, especially governments that are democracies, look to the United States and take very seriously what statements issue from the United States government.
All right, very good. And finally, what do you think the lessons are in this whole tragedy for Baha'is in America and around the world, and just for people of goodwill in general?
Well, I think the lesson here is that adherence to principle and steadfastness are, in the long run, the most important things to keep front and center. And I say this because 40 years ago, not only was the government of Iran hostile to Baha'is under the Shah, but also the average Iranian citizen had a very negative view of Baha'is and the Baha'i faith. And that continued during the early years of the Islamic Revolution and continued until fairly recently. But we're beginning to detect through a great deal of anecdotal evidence that although the attitude of the government of Iran remains hostile to Baha'is, the attitude of the average Iranian citizen appears to have changed markedly. And the reason for that is that they have seen the unjust behavior of the government towards Baha'is, and they've also seen, generally speaking, that the government is not fair in its dealings with the average citizen in a number of areas. And the result of the reaction of the Baha'i community and its adherence to principle, in other words, it doesn't engage in partisan politics, it doesn't call for regime change, it does not do things to create disorder in the society, you know, and certainly we are completely nonviolent and don't disobey the government. All of these things, despite the intense pressure on the Baha'i community, have caused people to look at the Baha'is and realize that their treatment has not been just. And one of the things that was most clearly evident of this was a letter that was put together by over 200 very prominent Iranians a few years ago. I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago, that started off by saying we are ashamed of the way that our country has treated its Baha'i citizens and calls for a complete change and an emancipation of the Baha'i community. This would have been unthinkable 40 years ago.
All right. Well, at least there is a glimmer of light on the horizon.
We certainly hope so.
All right. Anthony Vance is Director of the Office of Public Affairs for the Baha'is of the United States. Mr. Vance, thank you for being with us on Insight today.
Thank you.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight, which focuses on the 5 Years Too Many campaign, which commemorates 5 years of imprisonment for 7 Iranian Baha'i leaders and calls for their immediate release. Stay tuned. When we return, you'll hear from author Roxana Saberi, who herself was imprisoned in Iran on false charges and just happened to be put in the same prison where Faribah Kamalabadi and Mahvash Sabet were being kept. You'll also hear my interview with Iraj Kamalabadi. That's coming up next on this special extended edition of Insight on 90.9 FM Radio Baha'i. Welcome back to a special extended edition of Insight on the 5 Years Too Many campaign, which commemorates the 5-year anniversary of the imprisonment of 7 Iranian Baha'i leaders and calls for their immediate release from Iranian prisons. I'm Bakhti Larry Huff. Journalist and author Roxana Saberi was also imprisoned in Iran 4 years ago and wound up in a cell with Iranian Baha'i leaders Mahvash Sabet and Faribah Kamalabadi. Saberi shared recollections of her experiences with the two women on May 6th at the 5 Years Too Many event in Washington, D.C.
I was asked to speak today about my experiences with Mahvash Sabet and Faribah Kamalabadi 4 years ago. I was detained in January of 2009. and accused of a crime I did not commit. I was accused of espionage. After a few weeks in prison, in Evin prison in Tehran, I met two women, Mahvash and Faribah. I was taken out of my cell and put in a cell with them. Mahvash and Faribah told me they denied these charges against them, and they said, far from posing a threat to the state, Baha'is are nonviolent, they're politically impartial. Faribah added that the regime didn't want them to introduce their religion to others, but they felt it was their duty to share the tenets of their faith to those who were interested. I saw from the very first day that I met them that they seemed very calm, serene, despite the harsh circumstances they had been in, and I asked them, how can you remain so calm here? Mahvash explained, we believe it's natural for new religions such as ours to face challenges like this. We are trying to turn this challenge into an opportunity. Opportunity? I asked, surprised. What opportunity? Mahvash raised her eyes and looked, smiled at what must have been a perplexed look on my face. We trust in God to do what is best for our community, she said. If he thinks we can serve our faith better by remaining here, we accept it. But if you leave everything up to God and fate, I said, what room is left for a person's choice of action? Faribah shook her head. We don't leave everything up to God. We choose what we do and say here, and these choices are very important. In other words, Mahvash explained, we do what we think is right. By doing so, we are taking one step toward God, and we believe he will then take 10 steps toward us. Her words reminded me of a famous saying in Farsi, as toh harakat is khoda barakat, which roughly meant, oh, there are a lot of Iranians out there, which roughly meant, God helps those who help themselves. Mahvash and Faribah were helping themselves, partly by choosing to have a positive attitude. They tried to make the most of every day in prison. For example, they exercised in place in the cell every day. There wasn't a gym that we could go to. They discussed books that they were allowed to read. Their positive attitudes rubbed off on other women prisoners and helped strengthen their spirits too. Word traveled through the ward, the women's ward, quickly that if you were lucky, you'd get to room with the Baha'is, because they would help lift your spirits and help the days pass faster. Mahfash and Fariba also taught me a lot about compassion through their own examples. I told them one day, I know, as the saying goes, we're supposed to hate the sin, not the sinner. How do you not hate your captors? Especially you, Fariba, because Fariba had told me that her father had been tortured in an Iranian prison several years earlier and died shortly after his release. You know what they replied? We don't hate them, we forgive them. We believe in love and compassion for all humanity, even for those who wrong us. We don't want to become like them. We hope God will help us show them a better way.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight. That was journalist author Roxana Saberi speaking at the 5 Years Too Many campaign event in Washington, D.C. on May 6th. Next is my interview with Iraj Kamalabadi, the brother of Fariba Kamalabadi, who lives in Southern California. Hello, Mr. Kamalabadi, and welcome to Insight.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, and let me greet all your listeners, and I'm glad to be part of this program.
I know that this has to have been a challenging time for you and your family, given your sister being imprisoned in Iran, but also other fellow Baha'is as well. Can you first of all just tell me in general how this has impacted you and your family?
Well, it's not easy when one of your loved ones, a sister in this case, or in general, any immediate family members, is imprisoned because of his or her belief. So in the case of my family, is no exception. It is very tolling and very difficult, but at the same time, you know, we understand the root cause of all of these problems that have occurred for the Baha'i community of Iran, and basically the root cause of it is lack of knowledge or ignorance or lack of proper education.
Okay. When did you actually last see your sister, or when did you last speak to her?
I saw my sister last about 12 years ago or so in a family reunion that we had. And I was able to talk to her from time to time when she was in prison. The last time I had a chance to talk to her was about 7 months ago,
mm-hmm.
over the phone, and when she was able to call for about 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay. So you said it's been about 7 months. You haven't been able to speak to her again since then because it has not been allowed?
That is very correct.
How were her spirits at the time, and how does she say the spirits of her, if she knows, of her other fellow captives?
Yes, her spirit is high, and she's holding up pretty well. She is imprisoned with the other Baha'i lady who is the member of the ad hoc leadership of Iran, Mahfash Sabet. So she knows of her conditions directly because they're together, and she's doing well in terms of holding up, in terms of dealing with this issue. But both are physically tired and have gone through many health issues, and this has been the case for the other 5 men members who are held in a different prison. Their general condition, physical health condition, is poor and weary, but nevertheless, their mental condition, their spirit is very high and very strong.
How did she say they are being treated? And if any of them need medical care, are they able to get it?
The treatment has varied from time to time, depending on the location where they have been held in the past 5 years. At this point in time, where they are, the two ladies are kept in the Evan prison, they are doing relatively okay as compared to other times when they were in different conditions. And as far as medical treatment, from time to time, when an issue comes up, they do apply for getting permission to go and see medical help. But usually it gets denied a few times, and it takes about a month or so until, if it's serious enough, it is granted to them.
I see.
But at this point in time, they are doing relatively okay. There are no major concerns in terms of their physical health.
Okay. You're listening to Insight, the Radio Baha'i Public Affairs Show. And I'm Bhakti Larry Huff, speaking with Iraj Kamalabadi. He is the brother of Fariba Kamalabadi, who is imprisoned in Iran and has been sentenced to 20 years in prison because of her faith. Mr. Kamalabadi, are your sister and others able to get information from the outside? Do they know of efforts being made in the United States and around the world to seek their release, aside from being told perhaps by you and other family members?
Not really. The only source of information that they have is through their visit by their relatives. Mm-hmm. And, well, there's actually another source of information, and that is any of their cellmates, when they are in touch with their relatives, and from time to time when someone goes on furlough for a few days and comes back to prison, that's the only type of information that they receive.
I would assume that any information they get about efforts to seek their release is encouraging to them and gives them hope.
Yes, very much so. Any news of any activity that has been going on in support of their ordeal of being in prison is very encouraging and gives them hope and renewed effort to withstand the difficult conditions that they are in.
Right. What are your thoughts on the 5 Years Too Many campaign that was launched on May 5th?
It is a very effective campaign. I actually have heard in the last week or so many of the accounts of activities that have happened and have been undertaken throughout the world in many different countries and cities and communities. And the news of all these activities come in from time to time, and it actually has cluttered my email, and there are many phone calls that have come in with news of activities that have been going on. So it is very encouraging, and it has been very effective, and it continues to be. And we hope that it will send a very strong signal to the government of Iran to rethink about their policy in terms of violation of human rights. We hope that they would be set free.
As a native Iranian, what are your thoughts about the prospects for your sister and the others' release, and also about the prospects for the Iranian government maybe adjusting its attitude and providing a free environment for the Baha'is in Iran, but people of any other faith or beliefs, to practice freely?
We are always hopeful that the policies of the government would be revised so that it will be accepting of different beliefs and ideologies in the country. And all the political prisoners and ideological prisoners and prisoners of conscience that have different views and thoughts would be able to freely express themselves and to be able to come out of their captivity, the innocent people that have been kept in prison for no good reason.
I would imagine that perhaps some people in America, but perhaps not most, can truly understand or relate to not being able to practice their faith in their homeland. Can you provide some insight into how that feels, especially when the homeland is where your faith was actually founded? First of all, let me ask you, how long have you been in the United States?
I've been in the United States for about 36 years.
Did your leaving have anything to do with religious persecution?
No, I left Iran at the time where this was 2 years before revolution, the time where Iran was in relatively calm condition. And there were persecution of minorities, and especially the Baha'i community, but not to such a great extent. And even whatever persecution that there was, it was not government-sponsored. It was by different factions, and mostly religious factions and groups that do not have tolerance for other ideologies than the Shiite Islam, where was the predominant belief in Iran. But, of course, after the revolution, things have changed.
Okay. And now back to the other question. Provide us some insight into just how it feels not to be able to practice your faith in your homeland.
Sure, of course. You know, because the Baha'i faith is a relatively new independent religion that came to being some 170 years ago in Iran, at the time when religious fanaticism was at its all-time high, and the government was heavily influenced by the clergy. And ever since its inception, this has been going on in terms of Baha'is not being able to practice the religion simply because the Baha'i faith came after Islam. And then the religious clergy does not have any tolerance for a faith that comes after Islam, because based on their beliefs, the Prophet Muhammad is the seal of the prophets, and there was supposed to be no other prophets that come. But so they don't accept this. And that is the main source of the opposition and the persecution of the Baha'i community in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And it has taken many shapes and forms throughout this past 170 years, but it has heightened ever since the revolution has taken place. So it is very difficult for the Baha'i community, and for all that matters, for other religious minorities. Although the Baha'i faith in Iran is the largest minority religion after Shia Islam, but other religious minorities, such as Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians, are not able to freely practice their faith, and because of intolerance that exists.
Right.
Imagine, you know, in the case of the Baha'i community of Iran, from early childhood, from birth to death, and even after death, the persecution takes different shapes and forms. First of all, the Baha'i birth certificates are not granted. You know, when children are born to the Baha'i family, the government does not issue them birth certificates. So that's at the very beginning of a human being coming into this world, being persecuted. And then their Baha'i marriages are not recognized, and the government does not issue Baha'i marriage certificates to the Baha'i families. And then when they die, their burial ceremonies are not accepted, and they don't issue them death certificates or allow them to be buried according to the Baha'i burial practices. And even after their death, there have been many cases where Baha'i cemeteries have been ruined and destroyed and bulldozed. So from cradle to grave, the entire Baha'i community has been going under severe persecution.
I see. Well, given these conditions and this state of affairs, are there perhaps Baha'is living, like yourself, living outside of Iran, who would encourage other Baha'is to leave?
Well, some people leave because of their own personal reasons, but not everyone wants to leave. You know, these are a very peaceful, loving people that live in their homeland, and they have done nothing wrong to deserve any of these persecution that has been going on and inflicted upon them. And many of them love their countries. Everybody loves their countries. Many of them want to stay because they don't feel that they have done anything wrong. And some people may leave because of whatever personal reasons, but nobody is really encouraged to leave. It's left up to them, you know, if they want to stay even with this severe conditions that they have to go through on a daily basis. They love their country, and for many of them, they prefer to stay and live in these conditions in their homeland.
Okay. In the waning minutes here, what are you able to do here in the United States on behalf of your sister and the six others who are imprisoned? I know that you have done some public speaking in various areas of the country. What are you able to do to aid the cause?
That's a very good question. Usually when some persecution is brought upon a community, what is a more logical solution is to bring this to the attention of the authorities of the society, the country, and the city where they live in. But in the case of Iran, where the perpetrators of these human rights violations are various agents of the government themselves, where do people have to go to? Where do they turn for justice? So in the case of people and relatives who are outside and for people who have their loved ones imprisoned, the best thing we can do is to bring this to the attention of our local, regional, and national governing body within the countries and cities that we live in. So that is what I have been able to do whenever it is possible and whenever there is an opportunity for me to bring this to the attention of the authorities and legislative and lawmakers at different levels with bringing their plight to the senators within our states, to the congressmen within our area, and at the same time making use of the public media, the television, radio, such as this program, and newspapers to approach them with the intention of helping to shed light upon this egregious human rights violation, and at the same time to bring it to the attention of many human rights organizations that exist all over. And so these are the best thing we can do from this distance and from outside of the community where we cannot, you know, go for a visit and console them directly. But this is what we can do outside.
Okay. Did you participate in the congressional call-in today?
Yes.
All right. And finally, where is your sister's family, her husband and children, and how are they, and how frequently are they able to be in contact with their wife and mother?
Yes, my sister is married with 3 children. The youngest of her children is in Iran and lives with her father. So the 2 of them who reside in Iran are able to visit my sister on a weekly basis. And the other 2 children of hers, a son and a daughter, live outside of Iran. One lives in Australia, the other one in England. And they are going through school because they were denied access to higher education within Iran. They are now residing outside of Iran and getting their education. And as far as communication is concerned, again, in the last 6 or 7 months, nobody has been able to be in touch with my sister from outside. Again, the only immediate family members that are allowed to have weekly visits are her husband and her younger daughter.
Okay. Well, Mr. Kamalabadi, we appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today, and we trust and pray that soon you'll be reunited with your sister and the other members of the Iran as well. Mr. Iraj Kamalabadi is the brother of Fariba Kamalabadi, one of the 7 imprisoned Iranian Baha'i leaders. He lives in Southern California. Mr. Kamalabadi, thank you for being with us on Insight today.
Thank you very much for having me and for giving me this opportunity to speak to you today.
During this program, you've heard a good deal about Fariba Kamalabadi. We will share with you now information about the other imprisoned Iranian Baha'i leaders.
The 7 are Mrs. Fariba Kamalabadi, a developmental psychologist and mother of 3, who was denied the chance to study at a public university as a youth because of her Baha'i belief. Mr. Jamaluddin Kanjani, a once successful businessman whose factory was confiscated by the government because he is a Baha'i. Mr. Afif Naimi, an industrialist who was unable to pursue his dream of becoming a doctor because Baha'is in Iran are officially denied access to colleges and universities. Mr. Saeed Rezaei, an agricultural engineer who ran a successful farming equipment business in Fars province for more than 20 years. Mrs. Mavash Sarbet, a teacher and school principal who was dismissed from public education for being a Baha'i. Mr. Behruz Tavakoli, a former social worker who lost his government job in the early 1980s, also because of his Baha'i belief. And Mr. Vahid Tisfam, an optometrist known for his voluntary service to children and young people. Under international law, the seven Baha'i leaders in Iran should never have been arrested in the first place. It has now been 5 years since they have been wrongly imprisoned. 5 years too many.
Thank you for joining us for this special extended edition of Insight on the 5 Years Too Many campaign. For more information about the campaign, visit the Radio Baha'i website at WLGI.org or Baha'i.us or BIC.org. If you have questions or comments about this or other editions of Insight, please call 1-866-501-9544 or email info@WLGI.org. Insight airs Mondays and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., 7 p.m., and midnight. Join us again next time for another edition of Insight on 90.9 FM Radio Baha'i.